This is The Financial Coconut, Singapore's first personal finance podcast network. And I'm Timothy Mazier, editor-in-chief of Blockhead. Join me and the crew on our weekly Friday segment as we filter out the noise in the crypto space and keep you updated on the ideas that actually matter. This is Blockcast.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Yeah, how are you guys? You can tell my voice is off, right?
Hello, hello, hello. I'm Mark and I am the CEO of Blockhead.
And this is Tim, managing editor of Blockhead.
So how's Chinese New Year for you guys?
Pretty chill. Yeah, can't complain.
Yeah, I stayed in for most of it with a cough.
Do you guys realize that, yeah, is it weird? Like, I find that my memories of Chinese New Year is that it's very hot every time. And this is one of the rare Chinese New Years where it's just been raining every day. I can't remember the last time it rained during Chinese New Year.
I know what you mean. It's like how my memory of London is just cold. Although I went in summer. I was just telling my friend, yeah, I think something I went like in winter. And I was like, no, we went in summer. I was like, oh, really? It's just so cold. Right, so I get what you're saying, but it is very cold. So great lah. Shout out to the cold weekends that all of you have. But the market is very hot, right? So I think
yeah. I thought, you know, that's finally when Bitcoin will take a breather. But
No. Yeah. No. Bitcoin is very hot today, right? So that very conveniently slides us into the first story of today. Yeah, not rehearsed. It's just so smooth that we didn't stage this. I love it. Okay. So the first story of the day is that Bitcoin hits US 23,000. Woohoo! Right, so it has since rise about 40% year to date, right? Reaching what is about a 5-month high, right? In other words, Stan Chart is wrong, lah, right? Stan Chart was the one that was hypothesizing it would go down further, right?
I think that was their price target, if I'm not wrong. I mean,
yeah. Okay, don't say too much. Later, they cancel my sponsorship. Huh? But anyway, so it is hard to do this kind of prediction. But the idea here is that, yeah, Bitcoin has broken into the 23,000 range and, yeah, has went through quite an interesting cycle over this past few weeks, pretty much. It's just a few weeks, right? I remember a few months ago, we were just like, oh, what's happening, right? And these few weeks, things have kind of moved up, right? And all sorts of reasons that people will hypothesize because of GDP la, Feds, you know, more and more dovish with the interest rates hike la, and all those kind of things. So there's all sorts of reasons. I personally don't dare to stand on all these kind of reasons because a lot of times they're correlation. I'm not sure if they're causation. But yeah, anybody has any thoughts around this? It's a situation. Yeah.
Well, I would like to kind of, you know, as a starting point, remind everybody about in the not so distant past where we were once looking at Bitcoin as a hedge, an inflation hedge, you know, and as digital gold.
But that was that. But that,
right?
That,
so like,
are we past that already? Are we past that idea?
I think we are past that idea, but like, you know, this was just, I would say, yeah, I mean, like, you know, like about a year and a half ago, we were still talking about this.
Yeah, then 2022 just kind of threw that narrative out the window.
Because you started saying correlation equals one.
No, but the talk about, you know, whether it's a hedge against market risk and all that, I think that's still
really
relevant.
I think as market participants, which means like the big financial market participants enter the game, it's going to be very hard for it to be not correlated with the financial markets. Eh? And my team, I think about a year plus ago, we already talked about this, right? We observed very serious correlation between the NASDAQ and like Bitcoin prices, right? So there's very serious correlation there. I don't know if there is an inflation hedge or, you know, is it like really like a goal that runs counter. I find it hard to take that position.
I think that, you know, in my opinion, it's got nothing to really do with like, you know, how the asset actually functions, because if you think about, you know, like the kind of qualities it has, right, you know, so it's limited supply, it's scarce. I mean, with the halving coming up next year, so there is going to be a limited amount of like gold in circulation. So I think this is one area where this whole thesis of like, you know, like it being an inflation hedge and digital gold is kind of built on, but it won't be an inflation hedge until it actually becomes one, you know what I'm saying? in a sense that what I think that the catalyst, you know, for that to happen is that we're looking at a complete failure of the financial markets, or like a serious kind of like catastrophe, you know, like a war, right? And then that's when you would see an asset like this, you know, behaving the way that, you know, we've kind of made it out to be. But when things are kind of like, you know, working normally, and you know, like the financial markets and the financial institutions are still solvent, and you know, they're kind of behaving like it should, this is where we're going to see that correlation still.
Yeah, fair. But I think it's interesting for our listeners to note that over the many, many crashes, there's just been increasing amount of Bitcoin wallets, more and more Ethereum wallets. Yeah, essentially more and more and more, despite there's a lot of crash, right? So in other words, underlying adoption is just expanding. Right, and it's just so interesting.
Yeah, and Mark, I mean, you also raised an important point, like, that the reason why it was, you know, or some still see it as a
wake
hedge
up, la, against don't, inflation la,
is because it's it's because its supply is limited, la. And you, yeah, I mean, you mentioned the halving.
Don't, la, don't.
In 2024.
Don't, okay, guys, yeah. Just don't. Don't subscribe to this kind of narrative. What inflation hedge, la, all that. I was like, I really don't know if you can draw this kind of, because it doesn't have historical, like sufficient historical records to substantiate its position as that tool, you know, but the underlying function, it has its own underlying function, but to call it a kind of like a hedge against inflation or a hedge against or inverse tool against the market collapse, right? Is something that I'm like, I could not very sure. And I find hard to stand and I want to just make everybody wake up. <It's>
like, I completely agree, Reggie. I think my earlier point was that, like, you know, it is not, I mean, like, yeah, we shouldn't see it as an inflation hedge now, but that doesn't mean that it can't become that. You know, like down the road. But it's also not a practical situation to hope for, because, you know, that could never happen.
Yeah, no, but I actually do agree with that doomsday scenario. If that happens, you know, given a decentralized kind of like a function, right, where essentially your compute power is all over the world, right? If one part got bombed, the whole thing can still function if there's no corroborated like tech on it, right? So I actually understand and I agree with that doomsday scenario, right? But yeah.
But you see, even in a doomsday scenario, right, if you have physical gold, right, you can hide it under
that
your bed.
That is fair point too.
You can't do that with like Bitcoin. So that is still that vulnerability there. You know, there's a reason why we use kind of like, you see our the cold wallet. Okay, cold wallets again, guys. Right. Right. You see, like, you know, the most secure version of like, you know, like cryptocurrency storage, right? It's also the most old school. You got to write down your like your seed phrase, you know, right? So I think that's that part of it where if you're looking for something that is a real kind of like some measure of safety for in the doomsday scenario, right? You're looking at something that's also very archaic in terms of its technology.
Yeah. I thought you were going to like smooth into a sponsor message. Huh?
No, I was just trying to make analogy, right? Where like, you know, like I think in a doomsday scenario that could work out. But at the same time, if you really want to compare it to gold, right? Like physical gold is something you can carry around. You can't carry Bitcoin.
Yes, and Russia and China continues to accumulate more physical gold. That's a different story for another day. But yeah, so that is pretty much. Anybody, any things you want to add, you know, other than being a cheerleader for Bitcoin? I think that there's no lack of cheerleaders out there.
I mean, all signs still point to a pullback, lah. So, I mean,
So it's
I still
a dead cat bounce, you believe?
At this point. Well, it's gone on too long to be called that, I guess. But just like the general macro outlook and situation as it is, isn't looking too positive, you know, across the board and cryptocurrencies included. Lah.
I just want to say, after 10 episodes, Timothy sounds more rational now. or more afraid. I don't know. But we learn as we go along. You know, but I also find hard to take that position. I just find hard to predict where things will go. I mean, I'm not a trader, right? So from a fundamental standpoint, I think the network is definitely continuously building. It's getting stronger, you know, but as to how token kind of pricing mechanics, that part I'm still like, how are we going to price these things? You know, I have no real clue, lah.
How do you feel about gold, Reggie, as an investment?
Consensus, law. There's a lot of consensus around it, right? So, and when I say that, people are like, yeah, Bitcoin also got a lot of consensus, which I don't disagree, right? So it's really a consensus trade at this point in time in terms of physical gold, right? Like it's historical, people like it, people, you know, have find some interesting faith in it. So, yeah, if pebbles were the consensus, my goodness, HDB flats are amazing, right? So it's just so many pebbles on the ground. But yeah, it's just gold is gold, right? But the idea here is a lot of central banks are accumulating gold, right? So that is, they drive the consensus in that sense.
So how do you feel about Bitcoin taking the place of gold in the portfolio?
Yeah, essentially, the idea here, if central banks take Bitcoin as their reserve, right? Okay, then all is approved. Yeah, because the big money needs to come behind the consensus before it becomes a real reserve. You know what I mean? Right? So to the day where a very big entity, whether is it Bank of England, Bank of Japan, or one of those like Bank of China, which is unlikely at this point in time, like one of the very big central bank come out and say, we're going to take this as an official reserve, then you also will expect Bitcoin prices to fly.
Yeah, I think when that happens,
Yeah. So, but will that happen? I really don't know because unlikely it will happen with the US, at least for me, because it runs counter to their system, right? It challenges their own core system, which they're making a lot of money out of, right? So, I'm not very sure about that. But that's essentially driving consensus. But at this point in time, everything is a pipe dream until the consensus come together. Yeah. Nice. Okay. So that is our very first story. On over to you, Mark. Next one.
Actually, I'll take the second one.
Okay, well,
yeah. I sense it. Tim wants to talk about this, yeah.
The second story is an article that we carried last week about investors in Sparrow, options trading platform for digital assets. They want their money back, basically.
Who want their money back?
Investors that put money in Sparrow in 2018 when they raised a total of $5 million in an ICO project. They say the ICO that they were promised never materialized. And compounding the issue further is that after getting the MAS license, Sparrow was acquired by Amber Group. Yes. Temasek-backed Amber Group acquired this options trading platform, Sparrow. Initial investors, the ones who put in the $5 million, are being ignored on both sides. So basically what happened in 2018, this was the time of the ICO boom, right? Sparrow raised money via ICO, promising tokens. These tokens were issued, but they were never listed.
So they never floated on an exchange ever?
No. Sparrow basically took the money to set up their exchange, which then failed. These investors alleged that Sparrow basically took the money for business development. And then they also say that Sparrow copied QCP's business model, which had some success. And then they sold the company to Amber, but never did anything for the token holders. Yeah, we were given a whole trove of documents, including the sale agreements, like recordings of the pitch meetings, of meetings with the founders of Sparrow. Yeah, it's like a couple of hours of like audio recordings, like all the documents, WhatsApp chats, everything. Police report as well. Well, the guy that got in touch with us, I mean, everything's all, on Blockhead in the article. His name is Sean. So his company, I think it's called NWD Holdings. They invested $180,000 in Ethereum. So at that time, price of Ethereum also different. But basically, they put in $180,000 in the ICO. They were saying that the guys at Sparrow promised them, cited like 88x returns. And saying
88x returns.
Well, I mean, like that is like. They gave a range, guys. Come on, they gave a range. If I recall correctly, it was between 10 to 100x or something. No.
They said that their other projects got 10 to 100x.
I mean, because 88x is a very, very specific kind of
number.
That is freaking ridiculous, guys.
But we're not within the realm of crypto. It's not that ridiculous. Sorry, I just had to jab there. But yes.
Fair enough. But I guess one of the most damning things, or like the, I would say damning, but like peculiar things about this thing for me was that after you kind of okay, you raised the money for an ICO, you got the tokens, right? 20 to 2021, that was like the DeFi summer, everything, all there was the ICO boom, major bull run, right? Basically you kind of throw a dart at the board or whatever, right? You're going to make some money. And the tokens should have been listed during this time and it was not.
Yeah, that's what they are unhappy about.
And so that to me is actually, it was clearly the right time to list at that point in time. Everybody would have made money at that point, in my opinion. Obviously I'm simplifying things a bit, but I think that the optics of that, they don't look good.
I mean, everybody, you mean who? Like the people that come and carry the bag, maybe not so. Right?
I don't know. During that time, it's in the middle of COVID, quantitative easing. I mean, similar to the stock market, right? Pretty much everything was in the green.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Don't like that. Draw a comparison. Very sensitive. But I know, yes. I know what you're saying. Yeah. Now, just like similar, now everything in the red, right? So much for no correlation. Mm. But anyway,
I mean, you know,
oh my goodness,
there were so many dodgy or like rubbish companies and projects that ICO'd during this period. But why we focus on this one is because, you know, Sparrow went on to get an MAS license and they got acquired by Amber Group just late last year.
Well, we can actually talk to Amber Group about this because we have their MD coming over to the podcast next week. So let's just see whether she will want to answer a question on this. But anyway.
No, you know, according to Sean and documents he shared, Amber says they have nothing to do with this. They say that you deal with Sparrow. This is not, like when they acquired Sparrow, they didn't acquire tokens either. So they're saying you ask them. And then Sparrow says, you know what? You can ask Amber. So even they got nowhere else to go, so they just went to make a police report lah. I mean, I don't know how useful that's gonna be, but
sounds like the Hoot, you know, the streaming service backed by Singtel. Same problem.
From my understanding, right, if it's a kind of like a pre-IPO kind of sale situation, right, and if the IPO doesn't go through, then the funds are returned, right?
It really depends on, okay, so I think there are a few things, right? First thing is, if you're not listed, then you're not governed by the code of conduct, right, essentially, right? Within the exchange, right, which is very extensive in that sense, right? Because no exchange wants to, you know, reduce its credibility, or at least in the stock market, because they've already gone through many rounds of merger and being established, right? So I think the crypto exchange, I don't dare to say that. You know, it's going into its own process of coming together. But if it's not listed, that means it's really most of the time governed within the agreement, right? So all the agreements that's being written down and all that. And pretty much you have to go to litigation now.
But do you know what the standard is? Like, you know, like the standard kind of, I mean, obviously that they are, is there like kind of like, you know, like a generally expected, you know, because I'm wondering, you know, in these situations, right, if we compare say IPOs to ICOs, right, is there like usually, you know, like a standard way that these things are kind of like governed? I mean, obviously there will be agreements that kind of deviate from the norm, but.
Yes. So I don't think there is a fixed way per se, you know, there are agreements essentially, and there are market practices. Right. So in that sense that it's just like how you will pay your property agent 1%, you know, for their sale. In the pre-IPO space, there's also these kind of arrangements where if it doesn't list, they will give you back and all those kind of things. Right. But it's not like every single pre-IPO is the same. And very likely by the time they go for pre-IPO roadshow, right, they already gotten some sort of like, you know, more or less an agreement to go up already. Right. Because underwriting takes damn long. Right. They got to go through all the accounting and everything. It takes damn long for it to go up. So by the time they do pre-IPO roadshow, is really at the last phase. Right? Rarely do companies pull out unless the market condition suddenly turns horrible. Like ManU or I think...
Or like the dot-com bubble.
It became a shit show. Everybody pull out and then they take a break. And then they return you the capital. Of course, that's the idea. Although it's the idea, like I said, it may or may not be depending on what's within the agreement that's been written down. Because sometimes the delay can be a few years, you know? And it's your opportunity cost lah, in that sense.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, I guess the reason for that, you know, that question also is because, you know, I'm thinking that I'm putting myself in the shoes of somebody who has never actually gotten involved in ICO before, right? Your closest reference point would be a pre-IPO, right? So it really comes down to, I guess, what was actually represented to these new investors, because, you know, the closest reference point would be an IPO situation. And in these cases, in most situations that I can recall, right, if the listing doesn't happen, I mean, like there is some amount of protection offered to, like, you know, the investors.
So I think the bigger problem here when people compare IPO and ICO, right, is that a lot of the times the IPO that you get, right, they are for matured companies already, right? Or the company has gone through very serious market fit, you know, they've gone through the growth cycle. Now they're going to the last phase, then they go out, they meet the public where it is, right? So there are some IPOs that are not like that, like especially in the pharmaceutical companies, right? When they go for an IPO, they really need the money. They really need the money to research. It's a very different kind of IPO, right? But I think in ICO generally, right, is a pipe dream at first, right? There's some sort of a model, some sort of a build up, you know, but it's a lot of, you know, it's still very, very, very early phase, you know, when, at least from the ICOs that I was looking at, like, when I first took a look, you know, at a few years ago, as compared to IPOs, which is a very different game. Yeah, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, I completely agree. I'm just kind of like, you know, speculating on what might have been represented to them.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. We had a look at the investment agreement and there is a section
with 88X.
You know, about,
what up? Okay, anyway, yes, let's continue.
No, there is a section about, you know, risk of abandonment or lack of success.
Risk of abandonment sounds so like adoption, like that. You know, oh, I have a kitten, then there's a risk of abandoning the kitten.
I mean, yeah, so I don't know if the investors actually have a case, lah. But what they're unhappy about basically is that, you know, the tokens didn't even list, so they had no chance at all to even get back a fraction of what they put in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, I mean, these things they have to litigate, right? And when they litigate, it's really going to the nitty-gritty of corporate law, right? And I don't really have a lot of background to give that, which is why it's very important.
At the end of the day, it's just contract law, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's so hard to litigate contract law. It's so hard, you know. It's like a lot of these contracts are written in a way that, you know, it cover all the katsung and they hire the best people to write these things, right? So I don't know. I've not heard many successful litigation against contract law. There are a lot of successful litigation against like company law, you know, which is like with private limited, you're under the Company Act and all this kind of thing. There are successful litigation there, and there are probably more successful litigation in like proving a fraud, you know, than trying to like
proving a fraud is actually very difficult as well.
Yeah, it's very difficult, you know, very but difficult, in terms of a lot of the high profile cases, right, I think it's quite hard to get back because a lot of these corporate law kind of cases, right, they get dragged so long.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's just a question of how much firepower. I mean, it comes down to like, you know, how much money was actually left on the table and whether it's worth fighting for it. I mean, if the exposure is like, you know, like say 180 grand, right? I mean, it's tougher. You know, your legal fees alone could set you easily, like, you know, if it goes to trial, like 300,000 to 400,000.
Exactly. Whereas in a fraud case, it's different because the state is litigating against fraud case. Right? Right. It's a very different game. The state will litigate all the way to the end, you know, if they need to do it.
And also, if I'm not wrong, Singapore doesn't allow class action lawsuits. So like, you know, like it's not like the US where like, you know, you can just band together like, you know, like 1,000 like, you know, disgruntled shareholders and then you go and screw the company. I think in Singapore that is not allowed.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe it's time we explore some of these things, you know. But that will bring us into a different podcast parameter altogether. But all the best to the Sparrow ICO guys. And if down the road you experience any of these things, you must let us know, okay? Right, please drop us an email at Blockhead, right? Where should they drop out if they have something interesting to share?
Hello@blockhead.co.
Hello@blockhead.co, or you can talk to me, hello@financialcoconut.com.
The message, I guess, you know, here, you know, it's in the public interest for us to, you know, also pursue a story like this. And it's a very simple thing that, you know, point we want to kind of just drive home, like, you know, with regard to ICO situations, obviously we're not in the same kind of like boom that we were in 2018, but, you know, if something sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
Yeah,
I mean, 88x returns, dude. I mean, like, it's just, it's...
Bro, it's hard one. It's a hard number.
No, but you know, I mean, these guys are also seasoned investors. You know, they're like, oh yeah, this is not... I mean, this is what they do for a living. They make investments, but even they get caught out, you know, or like, you know, I guess, you know, when greed takes over, you know, they said it was their first, like... crypto investment, they don't really know what they're getting into, but you know, you see like the potential for quick flip, lah. You know, they're like, oh yeah, you know, just put in your money and you get out in 6 months. Yeah, mm-hmm. Nothing comes so easily, I guess.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. There's some basic logic in it, lah. Right? Unless you're the fairy godmother, okay? Let's bring us to the third story.
Oh, the third story is actually a really funny one. Well, I mean, like, you know, someone has just spent like $1 million. I think US.
What?
US? Yes. $1 million, right? On NFTs, right? In this market.
What?
And it's a Singaporean guy. Singaporean person, right?
Okay. Singapore make too much money, nothing to do.
This is not a kicker, man. So he did to impress a Tinder match.
Wait.
So basically, the screenshots of the Tinder conversation were actually forwarded to us. And then like, I'm just going to kind of read like, you know, a couple of like lines of this.
It's not just one Tinder match. It's multiple, but this is just,
yo, I just spent $1 million on NFTs. Right. And then like, you know, like, I think the match was like, ? Huh? What do you mean? Oh, it's a... non-fungible tokens. It's proof of ownership, like how I'll own you eventually. Do you have a roadmap or utility? And then she just says, simple talk, impress me more, and that's it.
Are we? Wait, guys, wait, when we bring up this story, are we trying to show a use case?
That's a good point.
Are we trying to show a use case?
Well, look,
or?
The NFT collection in question
I
here
cannot,
is, you know, like.
I cannot. Yes.
It's like the D-God's NFT, like, okay? So it's actually one of the most popular projects around, right? But I mean, it's still hilarious, like, that we are, you know, first of all, like, you know, like, someone is actually spending that amount of money in this kind of climate.
I think how it came about was like, okay, so they are Solana NFT project, one of the biggest, and then they're moving over to Ethereum. So this guy on Twitter posted something like 1,000 likes and I'll sweep the floor, basically buy up all the available NFTs.
I thought he really going to sweep the floor. Please continue. I'm learning. Okay, give me some slack on this. Yes. Crypto language.
I mean, just for more context, right? The NFT project in question, right? You know, it's got over like the US $135 million worth of trading volume, right? So,
Yeah. So yeah, he got 1,000 likes and he made good on his promise to buy 69 D-Gods, which cost him US $1 million. And I think 900,000. So he bought the NFTs, and then I guess he needed to start making use of them and flexing it on various platforms. So yeah, I mean, that's all he's talking about on Twitter. And actually, the screenshots weren't shared with us, Mark. He posted all the screenshots himself on his blog. So
shit,
you know, not shy one.
Guy,
quite funny,
solid.
We
should get him into studio.
I have 69 D-Gods. We'll give you 5. If you reply, your loss.
Hey, can we get him into studio? Can you cast
the person? I have 69 D-Gods. I can send you proof of God. Question mark, huh? What are you talking about? You do not know D-Gods? I don't know. You are not worthy. I mean, like, this thing is just like, I mean,
thanks
it's
for making
clear
my
that,
Chinese New Year, guys.
No, I think it's quite clear that, you know, like, I mean, this is probably like, you know, like he's taking this, you know, in good humor, like, you know, but I mean, it's still a lot of money to spend on the joke. Huh? Yeah.
Of course. Anyway, we must really get this guy in. I really want to talk to him.
We're also trying to talk to him too. It's also interesting to have a conversation about, you know, investing in NFTs in this market. You know, I mean, $1 million is not something you can just, toss at something, like, you know, without.
Singapore got a lot of millionaires, just saying.
I mean, apparently he's
a lot of millionaires.
Apparently he's a big name in the NFT space over here. Like people know of him, and like,
what's his name?
I mean, on Twitter, he goes by the name Pokey, P-O-K-E-E-E.
I think it's just like poke.
Okay. Sorry.
And we did have a look at his OpenSea wallet, and he has like 3 Bored Apes and, you know, various other random things la. So
bro, Bored Apes are not very random things, you know. I mean, although the prices came down already, but you know.
I mean, yeah. No, Bored Apes and random things, yeah.
Oh, so, Bored Apes and things. Okay.
So
interesting.
I mean, it's still an interesting conversation to have with, you know, someone who spends a lot of money on NFTs, in this climate.
Hey, we must get him on, legit. Let's get him on. Yes. Oh my goodness. But
you
just want to
speculate what it looks like. Okay, I don't know.
We don't go there. We get cancelled before you come on, tell you. Right?
Yeah, I'm thinking maybe he wears like a sling bag, like a branded one, you know, the kind with a pouch.
I'm not going there with you. But... but I know what brand went through my head. But anyway, like, I think the idea here is like, I don't think we are shilling anything, but it's just like, is this a use case? Right. It's just people, you know, flexing, like, pretty much actually quite aligned with the whole idea of a collector thing, right? Like, you have all these random collectors that they just collect, and they form the base of any collection, right? And when they form the base of any collection, then they are the baseline to the price, right? So yeah, doesn't mean it's all about utility, doesn't mean it's all about, you know, function, because sometimes, you know, although I'm very big on utility, sometimes I feel like, yeah, must start it a bit. It's not all about utility. I mean, as much as utility maybe provide a long-term value, sometimes as long as a lot of people want that shit, right, it's just going to work.
Yeah,
right?
A big thing is community, right? Like, one of the biggest projects last year was Goblin Town, which was a free mint with no utility and no roadmap, no nothing. But, you know, the floor price of these NFTs, they reached like $13,000 at one point. And, you know, the Goblin holders, are super tight, they're going strong, and they got their own culture and thing going on. I'm not a fan of NFTs at all, but you know, this one is definitely interesting just because of, you know, what they represent and yeah, what they're not doing, basically.
So, yeah. You know, the question then becomes like, you know, if the D-Gods community are made up of people like this guy, would you want to be a part of that?
Why not? Why not? If they let me in, if the gods allow me, I shall bow.
you'll be let in just by buying one of these NFTs.
It's crazy. Right? Why? That's the problem. But yes,
okay,
yes,
you
yes.
know, but serious answer to your question about like utility right here, is this a use case, right? I think that like, you know, it's just a question of target audience. If he had matched with like somebody who was into the space, I mean, who wouldn't want 5D gods for free? Right? I would take that shit and go on a date with him if I was into that space. But you know, like if I was into the gods to begin with. So maybe it's just a question of like really trying to keep this going until he finds someone who is aligned with his interests, and then there you have that use case.
Yeah, or get enough followers such that you can monetize. Hey. Yeah.
So one could say that, you know, it wasn't anything to do with the strategy. I think he just need to kind of like, you know, maybe ask more people on Tinder and see what happens.
I don't think we went on a 10-minute spiel to talk about his Tinder strategy, bro.
Yeah, sorry. Segue. No, but this is relevant to your question on use case. Is this a use case?
It is. Yeah. It's definitely. And it's intriguing. Sometimes a lot of creators, when we create something, right, we don't even know how the people will end up using it, right? And then you learn as you iterate and we go along, right? So it's so amazing, so interesting.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Nice. Any last things anyone want to add for today's episode?
I think thematically it's quite interesting to see that, you know, even if it's like a bit of a crazy situation, people are still kind of like, you know, putting money into the space. I mean, this is the very, very isolated example. I mean, like you see the price of Bitcoin going up as well. To me, there's still a lot of dry powder on the sidelines, I think. And yeah, not saying that I'm, you know, fully optimistic about the scenario here, but like, you know, I think that it's interesting to see people spending $1 million on NFTs, you know, like Singaporean dudes. Yeah.
I love it. Right? I love how after 10 episodes of doing this with me, right, you guys are a little bit more level-headed.
I mean, definitely don't go and spend like your life savings on NFT projects, like, you know, but this is actually interesting if you have, it might inspire some people. I guess. Might inspire some people to do things. I don't know.
No, bro, we need to have our own NFT project, the Block Coco or something. I don't know. The Square Coconut. Okay, let's talk about this offline. See what's to buy. Okay, guys. Yeah, that's it. Pardon my nasally voice. We'll see all of you next week. Take care.
All right. See you guys. All right, bye.
Bye. Hey, coconuts. So yes, I hope you enjoy this new show that we're building together with the team at Blockhead. And the goal is very clear, right? We're not here to shill any token or be a cheerleader for any project, but we feel that there's a lot of development that's going on in this space that we could cover and continue to be a little bit smarter as investors. I mean, eventually you tune in every week to a financial podcast network so that you can be smarter with your investments. And if so happen this is something that you're looking at, the crypto space, Web3, Metaverse, all these kind of stuff, then that is where we're trying to cover, but not from the angle of like, this is good, that is bad, but really trying to see it from like, what is happening, how is it developing. And I hope you find this useful and interesting, right? So if you want to continue to get more coverage around the crypto space, check out blockhead.co, and then we will see you next week.